Adam Shartoff here, host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 435 of the podcast. I have a single guest on this episode. His name is Monahan. He's a friend. He's a talented filmmaker. And I think he's fun doing offbeat films. He recently, well, he was on once before. If you go back and find episode number 283, I had done a segment on a series of short films that were on Fandor. And he was one of the filmmakers that I talked to in that special segment way back, episode 283 of the podcast. But Monahan is back on. He's a Brooklyn-based filmmaker. A couple of years ago, he made a film which I recommend you try to find and watch called La Voz de los Silenciados, which is The Voice of the Voiceless. That came out in 2013. That, too, I happen to know is available for viewing on Fandor, at the very least. Monahan has a new film called Sea to Shining Sea. It's something of a hybrid. It is sort of a documentary, but, you know, taking a lot of license, let's put it that way. Two old friends, one is an American, the other is a black Dutchman, but they are really good friends. They know each other for many years. They met in Europe many years earlier. Now his friend is coming in to visit, and Monahan tells him, oh, no, wait, fly to California because we're going to drive my mother's beater. We're going to drive it across the country. So the movie becomes a road movie, but it takes a number of elements from narrative film, and as I say, it creates a hybrid of a film, if you will. You have to figure out what is fiction and what is not fiction by watching it. But I can tell you it's a comedy, and it is a lot of fun to watch. It will be playing this weekend on Sunday, October 15th, at the Bushwick Film Festival, I'm happy to announce. It's going to be at the Syndicated Movie Theater at 40 Bogart Street in Brooklyn, if you are around, at 3:15, again on Sunday, October 15th. The synopsis reads: a coast-to-coast journey across the fantastically flawed USA with two unlikely friends, a chocolate-complected Dutchman and his palest of pale-skinned American companion. Anyway, lots of laughs. It's a very enjoyable film. We'll keep you abreast of how to watch Sea to Shining Sea as time moves on. I believe it will be available soon to most anyone who wants to see it. Again, we'll keep in touch with you about it. But right now, let's get to my conversation with Monahan, this very interesting, enjoyable filmmaker, and then at the end there won't be any outro in this particular episode. We'll be just back in a couple of days with a brand new episode. So have a terrific weekend, enjoy yourself, and I'm heading up to Woodstock for that festival with them. I'll no doubt have plenty of content for the podcast as a result of that. This is Adam Shartoff in a conversation with the filmmaker Monahan here on Film Wax Radio.
Can I turn on the AC, man?
It's so freaking hot out here. If you keep turning on the AC, you're going to blow out the alternator.
But why do you have an AC in the car if you can use it when it's hot?
Whatever. What would be your ideal thing to happen in Vegas?
Get married in some kind of chapel.
Let's start this vacation with a trip to the hospital.
Oh man, you call that an infarct?
Arizona, Utah, New Mexico.
Where are we going now then?
Do you have any sunscreen?
You're asking me for sunscreen? You know, I was so scared. No, listen, man. I opened the door,
yeah?
And he looked at me like this.
What is happening here?
Man, this is... Don't you feel the vibe here? The energy? Are you sure this is the way to Vegas, man?
You're just completely thrown out in the dark, and you're
also. By the way, if you do go to somebody and say my film is great, what are you gonna?
Yeah.
You're in a position where you're slightly subjective, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
You're perceived as being subjective, so it's helpful to have a third party who has no true stake in it to sort of say...
Yeah, to vouch for you.
Well, the stake being, I want to keep my reputation as somebody who understands what a great film is, or what a great story looks like, or what a quality like project is.
And
so I don't want to put my name on something that's not that.
Didn't want to make them sit through some of Janglum's lesser works.
Yeah, it comes down to that. It's like, but if there's certain projects, and granted, most of them haven't or go back a while now. But there's a few of them that are really like, wow, these are so good. They're so not commercial and yet so entertaining at the same time. And it's interesting. I just did a podcast with one actor that's been in his films through his entire career.
Yeah.
Which is this older guy. His name is Zach Norman. He's that bald guy.
The bald
guy.
He's
always like, always deal making and, talking a mile a minute.
And
bluster. You know, he's always, but he's a sweetheart, that guy.
He's still alive?
He's always in his 70s. Yeah. I guess. Even his brother,
I guess he wouldn't be that old.
Even his brother's older brother, Jaglom's older brother, is alive. And I don't know. He's not working anymore, but he's still alive.
That's good.
So these are people that have great stories. That's, you know.
Yeah. Well, those are the people you want to talk to.
Yeah.
Especially like just old school people have been around doing interesting stuff for a while. It's so rare.
I love it. Yeah. I just also talked to the actress Lois Smith because she's in the new Michael Almereyda film.
Oh, yeah. Marjorie Prime?
Yeah.
How did you see it yet?
Yeah.
Was it good? Do you like it?
Yeah. I mean, I can't really, put this up. Because I would like to have Michael back on at some point, but I guess Experimenter. Did you see that one?
Earlier? Yeah, I did.
What'd you think of that?
From what I remember, I saw it how many years ago? It's not that old.
I think it came out probably in 2014 or 15.
Yeah,
right?
So it's just like 2 or 3 years old. But yeah, I just remember it being, I liked it more than the, I liked it. I don't know. I don't really, it wasn't like exactly my kind of thing.
Yeah, I understand.
He's trying different things, you know, and it's like he's not resting on his laurels and doing sort of, you know, predictable stuff. Do you have some water? That'd be great.
I'm sorry, I should have
one. No, it's fine. I'm trying to think of like what my favorite work of his is. I think he's really interesting have you ever seen him talk before? You've met with him and talked to him.
I've not seen him in a
live setting. He's wickedly smart. He really knows his stuff.
Yeah. And what was a little embarrassing is sometimes I'm so usually prepared.
Yeah.
But I'm not always 100% prepared. And so I guess I didn't realize how not 100% prepared that I was when I stepped into this situation with Michael Almereyda and not knowing what he was like. Yeah. And he's a nice guy, but he's pretty serious.
Yeah.
Not self-serious, but he's serious. There are people I've had on who take themselves seriously.
Yeah.
I don't think he's that person.
Yeah.
But I do think he is a seriously, in the thoughtful,
He's an intellect, for sure.
He is. So I felt a little bit more stupid, I guess, in that case, because I've seen a few of his films, so it's not like I'm...
Yeah.
But, you know, when you go in and you sit with somebody and they don't know who you are, most people that I talk to, well, let's say a certain percentage of people that I talk to don't know me.
Yeah, yeah. They don't know the stuff you've done.
Yeah, and they don't know how... So I'm just another interviewer.
Yeah.
And many of the people they run into probably don't know their work.
Yeah.
They're just there to review something for somebody or to...
Yeah, there's definitely a real difference between people who are interested in film versus like a real cinephile like yourself that you live it. So it's a big difference. And when you step into these situations, it's like you're always gauging how insider can the conversation be. And
yeah, it's interesting because I guess I'm a cinephile, but I'm also...
But you are.
But it's also I am, but I'm... It's more about being prepared. for the conversation, which is I'm probably as much, if not more, interested in. So therefore, or what, that's what my goal is. So if I watch all of Almereyda's films, it's not because I'm an enormous fan of his films. It's because I want to know what he's about as a filmmaker, and I want to be prepared. So that's kind of where I'm at. So I will watch often before going into it. So I come off as a bit of a cinephile because I'm just so prepared most of the time, but not all the time. And if I'm not going to be prepared, at least it should be with somebody who's a goofball, because so I'll be off the hook. Well, so I think it came off fine, but it wasn't my, I don't think it was my best.
Do you, I mean, do you think that this comes from your music background? Like, do you think it's one of those things that being also an audiophile, is that what you would say? Like like somebody who, I mean, you come from a music background, right? You
know,
you're a music fanatic. You're like, you take music serious.
I'm not a fanatic. Well, I guess it's interesting. I think in certain moments, I more moved and connected to music than I could be with film.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, I haven't thought about it like that. And I'm, even though I was always a musician, I took music from a very, very young age. I took theory and then piano and then guitar from, you know, all my life. But and I worked in the music industry, but that had nothing to do, really do with music, you know?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it did and it didn't.
The emphasis was on the industry.
So, you know, but that was a great place to work, but it wasn't, we could have been selling, you know.
Hot dog buns.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Right. Only if there was a really, 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 really good hot dog bun, they wouldn't have kept it. They would have just...
Pushed it to the side.
They would have used the one that sells more.
Yeah, of course.
That's the difference between...
And that's why music's where it's at right now.
That's why it's at where it's at, exactly. Anyway, Monahan.
Yes. Adam.
I'm letting people know.
Yeah.
I think you and I were introduced. I was doing a podcast for Kino Lorber, I'm not sure. But isn't that how we met? Through a short you were making.
It was, I think it was
when Fandor.
Fandor had the Fandor Fix, is what I think they called it.
Right.
Where it was Jonathan Marlowe and Amanda Salazar. They had
great comedy stylings.
Yeah, exactly. They're an incredible duo of, well, broad slapstick. And they were doing a thing where they were choosing a few of their filmmakers that are part of the Fandor family, and sadly they're not a part of the Fandor
family anymore. I know.
They chose a few of filmmakers and they wanted to do original content, and they said, you know, if you can do a short film do a film for us. They didn't distinguish between short and feature, but they, you know, based on the money that they were going to cough up, it sort of... for most people it would have to be a short, but they chose a few of us based on like submissions. Everybody submitted something.
Okay.
And then and now they've done it a few times. I don't know if they're going to continue doing it now.
Have they done it since after they left?
I think they did three rounds. I don't know if the new people in charge at Fandor are going to keep doing it, but basically they said, we can give you a little chunk of money, and then what they sprung on us was, and you have to do a Kickstarter too to raise the rest of the money.
Oh, right.
And that was like their, but that was fine. It was good. It was very challenging because we only had a week to put together the Kickstarter, and there's nothing a filmmaker hates worse than, you know, putting their face on camera and begging for money. I mean, it's highly embarrassing, but we did that, and then we raised the money and we were able to make a film, but we never intended to make a short. We always intended to make a feature because the concept for our film was a cross-country road trip, and you can't really push that into, 10 minutes. It's a pretty big country. I mean, it's like, it took a while to drive across the country.
If you could drive across Maryland.
Yeah. Maryland might be a short. Maybe Rhode Island. But driving across from California to New York, it required a feature. I mean,
well,
we could have turned
it
into a series. Yeah, it's finished. It's made. It's going out to festivals right now.
What is it called?
It's called Sea to Shining Sea, and
Sea to Shining Sea.
Yeah.
I love the trailer, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I don't normally say that, but I was actually looked at him like, come over and let's do the, you know, it's not even the most optimal time to promote it because festival programmers aren't going to give a damn about my telling them it's good. They'll make up their own minds. But it's still great to come in to talk to a filmmaker like you at this stage because it's of interest to lots of other people doing similar things who want to do or want to do similar things.
Well, I mean, I'm in a certain way, the way that we're making films, and when I say we, it's mainly my wife and I, Sheena Mathakin and myself. And
she should come on too.
Yeah, well, she's more articulate than me, so she's more interesting responses to things. But anyway,
we'll bring you both on again.
When the film comes out.
But let's do that.
But I mean, yeah.
If your publicist, so
she's the publicist. You know. So,
well, no, she's you may everything. Need to hire one when it
she's
comes
the,
out.
Yeah, too. And she's the reason for the trailer too. She cut the trailer together, it's so really it's all good. Her.
Yeah, it was nice. It's a really lovely looking.
Yeah, no, it's. I think.
It's
well,
very
I mean,
cinematic.
What I was gonna say is like we're sort of like the every person kind of filmmakers in that we don't have any connections. We don't know anybody really from the film world with. The exception of like Sarah Driver, who's helped us out massively, but you know,
but
no, she's like royalty. Good. So it's that's the one person, and she's totally helped. And now we're starting to meet a lot more. We've met Jonathan and Amanda, that formerly at Fandor, and you know, it's slowly starting to meet people.
Shape.
But really, at the beginning, we knew nobody. I mean, we were like complete outsiders in this world. But we just. You know, we're big film fans, and we really wanted to, make something.
Okay.
We can pause it for a second.
Let's put a pin. Yeah, I know exactly where we're at. And you also, by the way, have FilmWax and myself, of course, on your team, along with the former Fandor folks and Sarah and Jim.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still together, right?
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not announcing anything. I just, like, I was surprised. I thought, like, I didn't realize that they're this long-term couple.
Very
that's
long
amazing.
Term.
Yeah. Very long-term, right?
Yeah.
I got to get, because I want Sarah on the show.
Yeah, she's great.
And Jim.
But
I think it's a good way to get to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I know that he doesn't like doing much press because it
doesn't
drives
matter.
Him crazy.
I'm going to make it. He'll make an exception.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But I'm also want to do a book. So, yeah. So hold on, Jacob. Let's. Oh, yeah, he is good. And he makes good movies. He actually makes a lot of stop animation types of things.
That's how I started. I was in this anarchist, grade school in Seattle, and yeah, they got their hand the crazy. I mean, the school was started by like ex SDS hippies and Panthers and stuff, and they got their hands on these stop motion like Super 8, like Nikons and stuff that were being used by war photographers from Vietnam. They brought them back and they gave them to the school. They sort of donated them to the school, and all of us got into claymation.
Wow.
This was like right around the time of what's that guy's name? Will I can't remember the famous claymation guy up in I think it was Portland or whatever.
Oh,
but,
I don't know.
But we were like fascinated by this. He did like the California Raisins and stuff, but he did a bunch of like more hippie-ish stuff before that, and we were like, we loved that stuff. So we were trying to make claymation movies and all these stop motion animation movies, and yeah, those are, I mean, it's such a cliche thing. Yeah, it started by making, you know, it sounds like something that would come out of like...
Well, it still requires a tremendous amount of patience.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, because they're still moving little objects.
Yeah.
Instead of clay, though, it's like Legos now,
yeah, yeah.
But they're still doing these very epic types of... incoherent stories that are very entertaining.
Yeah, they're more entertaining than most of the stuff.
Possibly. I'm thinking about doing publishing a book actually on particularly this area of Sarah and a lot of her colleagues from that time in New York. So it's like I've been bringing on a lot of folks from that era downtown,
the no wave era.
There's been the no wave in terms of but also encompassing music and art,
because
it's hard not to, because a number of these folks were doing all of those, like John Lurie, like Sarah Driver. They were all involved in doing number of different disciplines, so they didn't really differentiate,
of course it all overlapped.
But
I wish it was more like that now. I I mean, most of my friends are music people, so I still sort of, in my own way, I feel like I'm keeping that spirit alive. But, but yeah, like, it's like, why be genre specific? Right? It's like,
yeah,
all of it should be in conversation with each other.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately, the corporate, you know, monopolization of arts in the 80s and 90s really... you know, it put an end to that. I mean, we are in a position though to take it back.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there is when you think of it in any kind of careerist way, it sort of facilitates a kind of cliquishness of different scenes. And I guess I'm older. I come from the punk rock background where it's like everything's mixed together, and it's maybe it's a generational thing. But I think there's a lot of young people. I mean, like, I have more in common with the younger people that we work with that are like right around 20 than I do with maybe the people that are, you know, 10 years younger than me. And and yeah, I don't know why that is, but it seems like they have that spirit of like, everything's falling apart. We just need to start creating stuff and making stuff and getting our voices out there to stand up against the madness. But, you know, people are just a little bit younger. They're like, no, you must go and shake the hands with the Sundance people.
Right. No, you're totally right. I think that I had on Betty Gordon, teaches at Columbia as well as being a great filmmaker. And she was talking about like all those students, they're all talking about getting distribution. It's like her era, she was saying and sharing that they just were making shit. And that's kind of what you're talking about. Yeah. The same, maybe the next generation, and they're in a good position where they better figure it out because, I mean... Yes, you could try to find a distributor, and you may have a wonderful film on your hands. No doubt you do. It's just that there's like 8,000 others.
That's
the problem. One of the things I say is you might consider festivals being your distribution platform because, you know.
That's pretty much how it was with our first film. It was, we had a festival agent rather than a sales agent, and she's in Paris. Oh. She worked for Celluloid Dreams. Her name's Pascal Romanda, and she basically started a company just helping, you know, slightly smaller films just make sure they got in all the great festivals and stuff. And it worked out really well. I mean,
but she's still identifying the right films.
Yeah, she goes I mean, you can't go to her. She goes to you. And she found us in Thessaloniki where Jim was too. But anyway,
what's that?
Yeah, she found us, and she said, I really want to make sure your film gets seen by... everybody. And at that point, everybody had told us like, oh yeah, you did it all wrong. You're supposed to have a sales agent before you have your premiere. And we're like, we didn't know. And they're like, how'd you even get into this festival? And we're like, we don't know that either, but it was because of Sarah.
But don't a lot of filmmakers go to bring, let's say they just luckily get their film into Sundance and then find a sales agent at the festival?
No. Typically,
where the sales agent they've already hired.
Yeah,
finds a distributor.
Yeah, no, but what what we've learned.
We're talking about a market festival.
Yeah, yeah. But what we've learned is, you're almost for sure not going to get into Sundance if you don't have a sales agent or somebody trying to rep you to push you, because they have such a limited amount of slots.
Sure.
And you imagine half of those slots are already going to people that have been through their program. So it's a very limited amount of slots. And then you have people from CAA or whatever calling them every day. So our film's in there, right? You know, so they're getting all this pressure from that side of the industry. And then, you know, like if you're...
Just so they have better theatrical.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it's a marketing platform for their thing. So, I mean,
Laurels is just buying laurels.
Yeah, basically. And you know, a lot of distributors and stuff, they need that to sort of help market the film because, like, what else do you market it with? It's not the old-fashioned thing of, like, oh, here's a great story. It's like... this, you know, this one best new actress at Sundance, you know, that's where they get their marketing bang for their buck. So you're limited to, I mean, there's probably like two or three slots maximum open to complete nobodies. And you're talking about, you know, 8,000 films that were made that year, three people.
Yeah.
And that's even, I'm being generous. It's probably one person, if even one that
you
actually,
think?
Yeah, because everybody has somebody attached.
Everybody's gaming the system.
Well, nobody's going there with absolutely nothing. Everybody has some sort of angle.
And
I'm sure the programmers will tell you different, but that's part of their model too. They have
One ever made it to the top. Like, you know, I don't know. I just had on Jeremy Jasper, you know, whose movie opened the other day, Patty Cakes.
And,
you know, it's, I haven't seen it. It's a lovely film. So it's very conventional in its structure. It's about the underdog, you know, with the big dreams, and you know, there's all those, you know, the characters telling him they can't do it, and, you know. But I wonder, because I don't know that he, I don't know that this team had any angle, but it made it to the, it won the big award there.
No, it was huge at Sundance, right? I mean, it's, and it's like, but I'm pretty sure he, you know, typically you have some sort of connection or some sort of angle that allows you to get in there. I mean,
I gotta, find out. I'll find out the next time when he's not, when he's not working with a, with Fox Searchlight publicist. Or,
you know. Was the Fox Searchlight publicist sitting next to him when he did the interview?
Whispering in my ear.
Yeah. Wow.
No, I'm kidding. No, they, sometimes that is the case.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Many, many times they're not in the room, but you know,
that's good. They just set it all up.
Yeah.
But no, it's hard to get into festivals. It's really hard.
It is.
And when we they told us you're supposed to have a sales agent before you come to the festival.
That's good.
And
to
every
know.
Sales agent will tell you, we don't want to get involved with you if we're not there at the beginning, because if we're not there, we can't plan and strategize your festival life for the film before, because that's what they need to do.
And I mean, they need to be able to go to their next client and say, I just got this film into Sundance.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Let's, they can, then they can move up their own level of clients and ask for more money because they have, you know, I understand. But I do want to say I'm so lofty and arrogant. That's, you know, that host of this little podcast. But I believe one of my missions, I have all these goals to change this entrenched system, which is, I believe, is corrupt. But I don't find it. I don't think it's corrupt. I don't think it was an intentional. It's just like this natural. It's sort of like gentrification.
Yeah.
Gentrification comes to a city like New York.
Yeah.
There are two ways. One is an organic type of gentrification where, because of various sociological trends that are happening urban in cities and outside of cities, is that waves of certain demographics and colored people come into cities and neighborhoods and. Or they move from one neighborhood to another. That's just kind of the way things go and have always gone as long as there were cities. Then there's this other kind of what I call inorganic gentrification, where developers and politicians decide that they're going to rezone neighborhoods and they're going to all make a bundle of money and destroy neighborhoods and communities. Okay.
And sometimes there's a little bit of overlap between those things.
Often, yes. So there's nothing that's quite so binary. Likewise, I feel like this happens to a lot of areas, and one of them could be the you know, this world we're talking about. And I don't know that we find ourselves in this place, but I know that there are inorganic things going on, and I feel like we can push up against them. And one of my missions with this podcast, you know, is to say, you know, there's great festivals that are out there that are where the programmers and the, you know, the board, whoever's running them, really are there for the right reason. You know, they're there to find the great films and make an enjoyable experience for attendees. It's not, they're not markets necessarily, but that they should be, they offer pedigree to any, they should be able to be as a great opportunity for filmmakers. You know, I mean, I talking to these people that premiered at Maryland, and I'm like, you know, you shouldn't have to just have Sundance, South by, and, you know, Tribeca.
Yeah.
There should be these new waves that are actually as important, I think, you know.
And I think part of that is for distribution and, you know, just also sales agents or whatever. But they need to recognize, they need to sort of break the myth that it's only those, you know, three festivals that matter. I mean, it really needs to...
Right.
Be from all sides, and
South Bay isn't even technically a market, right?
No, and you know, these places. I mean, again, it's more about the laurels than it is about even the quality of the films. I mean, it's, you know, it's all subjective. What's a good film to one person is, you know, maybe crap, and it's maybe crap to you on a different day. You can watch a film one day and it's great, and the next day it's not. But, like, you know, what is the metric that people use to determine whether something's worth seeing? And we all have different ideas on what's good and what's bad, but the distributors, everybody's sort of flailing right now because nobody's really making money. Nobody has like a model where things are actually getting seen to the degree that they need to be seen. Nobody knows who's really watching stuff on VOD. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's numbers there, but nobody reveals them. So, it's all really tricky. And I mean, you know, people are making great stuff, and you know, there's got to be a better way. But yeah, they should be championing these other festivals at the same level that they're championing the big three or four or whatever it is, you know.
Oh, what's the fourth in your...
I mean, I would say Telluride is probably the best, but that's like even more exclusive than anything else. It's like you have to be a huge name, but the quality of the films there probably seems like it's the best.
Yeah.
But
it's not a market, right?
Yeah, but it's not a market at all.
I don't know that it always matters anymore. That's an interesting, like, one thing. I mean, what does it matter? I mean,
like, if you got into Telluride, you're selling your film a lot quicker than you do if you get it into a market, you know, like at a market festival or whatever. I mean,
it's something nobody knows about.
No, it's just the prestige of that name will help whoever is trying to sell your film a lot easier than... I'm talking like I'm on that side of the industry.
I know.
I only know this from my filmmaker standpoint. But I just, you know,
So you have one feature.
We have now two features. I mean, the second one's done.
Sea to Shining Sea is done.
And the first one is La Voz de los Silenciados, which came
out.
Say
that again?
With La Voz de los Silenciados, or The Voice of the Voiceless for the Gringos. Okay. Yeah, it's basically Factory 25 put it out, and we were introduced to Matt.
How does it? I think he sent me. That was just. Did you just recently get out of Factory?
Well, we've been hooked up with him for like a year and a half, and we have
finally just got back. He finally just answered your first email.
No.
I'm teasing Matt. We can
tease Matt, but basically, it took a long time because he's a one man operation. I mean,
Is he still doing distributing music too?
Yeah, he's doing music too, and he's not as much, but sometimes it's correspondence or connected to whatever the film is.
Right.
But he's pressing vinyl. You know, he's still doing his thing, making cassette tapes again. Basically, we had this great idea of doing this live score with the film, and so it took forever to find a venue that we could actually do this. And we were talking to the different theaters, and it's, you know, even with distribution, it's hard to get into the theaters. And it's like, you know, some of them weren't right, and they didn't know if it was going to go well. So we ended up just doing it ourselves at this like epic church. And but originally we were having my friends Prince Paul and Edan do this live score, but then we found this church and it had this crazy organ, and neither of them are organ players. So we had the guy who did the original score for the film, named Michael Kaufman, aka Edward Korft, and he's an amazing musician too. And he played the live pipe organ during the film, and it blew people's minds. It went over really well. It's a silent film because it's the protagonist is deaf, so
it's his POV.
Yeah, it's actually her POV.
Pardon me.
And so the entire film is placing you in sort of the headspace of this protagonist, and she's amazing. She's like, you know, she had never acted before,
and it was shot in the Amazon.
What did you say?
Where did I pull that out of? I thought for some reason when I first was in touch with you, you were on a trip.
No. You're thinking of Ben. He shot something in the Amazon.
That's right.
Yeah, but no, this is
because I got a couple of you guys. You're all part of that fix.
Mixed up. Yeah.
Fandor fix.
Yeah,
thing.
He was My part apologies. Of the Fandor fix. He was in Suriname actually, where the lead actor of our new movie is from. Anyway, it all gets confused.
It does.
It all overlaps. But no, we started that one in Guatemala, and we actually got free plane tickets to fly to Guatemala to shoot the opening scenes. And then everything else that we shot up here, we shot for free on the subways illegally, you know. And it's a
stolen shots.
Yeah, stolen shots on our great MTA. But it worked out really good, and now it's like on Vimeo on demand and on Fandor, and it's going to be on iTunes and all that stuff next month. And
good, perfect timing.
Yeah,
we can promote it for the iTunes.
It's the website's lvdls.com.
Rolls off the tongue.
You know, but yeah, it's we're very proud of it. I mean, it played all over the world.
I think you sent me a link.
Yeah, it actually played. It had a theatrical run in Iran before it even played anywhere in America. So I mean, that's sort of a first. Yeah, we played at the film festival in Iran and Tehran, and it went over really, really well there.
You didn't have the language.
No, there's everybody there speaks English. It's like everybody. Okay. I would say 80% of the people there speak perfect English. And it's, there was a longer Q&A than the movie. The Q&A lasted 2 hours, and the movie's only 80 minutes.
Is that true?
Yeah, totally.
Amazing. They're starved. You know, this was one of the most culturally rich countries, little in cities, Tehran. Right? And then
it's
the Shah.
Culturally rich. It's just that they have all these limitations of what they're allowed to actually say, but they find very clever ways of saying
it. Because they're intelligent and ambitious and will not be silenced. Like your character.
Yeah, exactly. That's a voice of the voiceless. Nice little
callback.
Callback. But yeah, I mean, there's amazing filmmakers there doing amazing things, but they still run into trouble. I mean, one of the people we stayed with while we were there is a young filmmaker who was thrown into jail right after we left. And so
not for hosting you.
No, not for hosting.
Nothing to do with
but
that.
for a documentary that he did where they claimed that it was, and I know because I helped them with the translation that there's absolutely nothing in there that, could even be seen as blasphemous or whatever they said it was that they threw him in jail for. But he's out now safely. But he was there for like 6 months. It was all over the newspapers and stuff. Yeah. And crazy.
Do you know Godfrey Cheshire?
Yeah, I know the name. I've never met him. But
yeah, he's a big advocate of the Iranian cinema.
Yeah,
he has a new book coming out.
I'm sure I'll check it out for sure.
Yes.
But yeah, he's a great critic and great minds. And he has good taste, so...
He does. You should see his documentary. It's really good.
About Iranian cinema?
It's not. It's about his family who were owned, like they were plantation people.
Oh, I've heard about this. Yes.
Midway. Yeah. It's a really good movie. Yeah, that's how I met him. Like I screened it. Like I did a screening and I had a film series.
Yeah, he's sort of like the inverse Ben Affleck or whatever. he's owning up to his antebellum, what is it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The ghosts in the closet or whatever.
What are the Affleck? What is the...
Ben Affleck was famously on the Henry Louis Gates, the Skip Gates TV show where they check your DNA and they found out that his family were slave owners and all this stuff.
DNA?
He like told PBS, you better not release that. I don't want anybody knowing that.
That's so stupid.
Yeah, it's like,
the sins of the father. I mean, come on, what are you really worried? Not only that, I would imagine he'd be own it. You know,
it's better to, it's better to go and say, this is a horrible thing that my family clearly did something awful and I benefited from, and I'm going to use this to speak out against the legacy. But that's the problem with
And then they moved up to Cambridge.
Crazy.
I had on an actor yesterday who's an old friend of mine, Matt Mayer. He went to the summer camp that I was at the time that he was there as a camper. I was a counselor already, so I'm older. Yeah. But during the same mid 80s years, Ben Affleck was also a camper at the camp. And so we were talking about that. And although the Afflecks have been very kind to this actor, they've given a lot of work over the years.
Yeah.
So he's,
I'm sure.
But it doesn't make any sense.
I'm sure that Ben Affleck's a nice guy. It's just that, we have a shared history in this country that we need to deal with. And clearly recent events show why. And, most people are ready to stick their heads in the sand because they don't want to deal with their own culpability or, whatever. And it's like, the rest of the country's like...
How much more power would the words, if someone like Ben Affleck, it doesn't have to be Ben, but somebody who has the similar situation where their ancestors were slave owners could say, I apologize for my ancestors.
Yeah.
I mean, that would carry so much more power than...
Yeah, use it as
just
a,
being
as
a liberal Hollywood type.
Teaching moment, learning moment. Yeah, yeah. But... It's like the same thing. Why is it Colin Kaepernick that's taking the knee? Why aren't there quote unquote white players taking the knee? It's like it's their responsibility too, but you never see that. And now finally there's like this white player is, standing by his teammate's side and, but like it's always the lead is always Black America, and then there's like slowly, very slowly in the molasses kind of snail crawl, a few, thoughtful, pale-skinned brothers and sisters that will go and put their hand on the shoulder. But it's like, come on, shouldn't you take the lead? It's like your responsibility. You're the one that, benefits from this privilege.
Yeah.
Take the first step.
Yeah. I don't want to get too far afield, but it's taken 100 years for people to finally say, these statues, you know, they should probably be taken down.
Yeah.
You know, it's most people think it's like more than 100 years because antebellum South actually was gone well over 100 years ago. But in fact, these statues went up during Jim Crow South era.
Of course, yeah.
So that's the dirty secret behind that they use as intimidation once blacks got the right to vote.
Yeah, this is post-Reconstruction. It's all of the
failure of the Reconstruction that these statues could still be. You know, it does get to this point that those treasonous people should have been imprisoned and... There should never have been Confederate evidence anywhere ever. Like the moment it should have been considered treasonous to put up any kind of Confederate symbolism at all, ever.
Yeah.
If they had done it successfully at the beginning, it would not be an issue 100 years later.
Yeah. But they capitulated and they sort of...
Right. It was their way of trying to make the peace.
Yeah. Making the peace with... But it's privileging whiteness over humanity.
And it's just... ends up being a viral infection in this country.
Oh, yeah, it's a cancer. And it's a cancer that if you've ever thought about it for 4 minutes, you know that it's something that could very easily be taken care of. But
so the thinkers know it now is their time. Now it's come up again. Let's just snuff it all out.
Yeah.
Have people feel cheated and upset, but fuck them. Let's move on because in about another 10 years, nobody will think, or in a year or two, nobody will give a shit about these.
To get rid of this cancer, it's going to require a lot more than
remove the limb.
Yeah.
Exactly. That is, in a sense, the discussion about independent film and festivals.
Well, it also ties into our new film, Sea to Shining Sea, because we actually tackle every single one of these issues.
Now, this is, from what I could glean from the trailer, you have a black guy and a white guy in a car, traveling across the country together,
very essentialist kind of terms. But
I'm the broad strokes. You're the
I'm the very 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 light skinned guy, and then my friend Borleiter from Amsterdam, he's a Surinamese guy that I was telling about. Like shot the documentary in Suriname. But anyway, yeah, Borleiter's from Amsterdam. He's one of my oldest skateboard friends. We're like best friends forever. Mm-hmm. He's been dreaming about coming to America. He, as a European, has been romanticizing America his entire life because of the propaganda that we spread throughout the world. He loves Levi's and James Dean and hamburgers and all the crap that we, propagate throughout. But he's also a black European, and he's totally terrified of the police and the prospects of being shot for no reason while traveling through the country. Anyway, he really wants to come visit America. He's been dreaming about this his whole life because he actually came when he was 18 and had to leave after 2 days because something horrible happened.
What?
And so it's sort of like a make-a-wish kind of film where my mother also called me like the same day that he called me and told me he could get time off work. And she told me, I don't want my crappy old Subaru anymore. If you want it, you can come pick it up, but you got to get it in California and drive it back to New York. And so I told my friend Borleiter, guess what? You're going to get to see America. Buy a ticket to SFO. Don't buy it to JFK. And he's like, what? And I was like, trust me, it's going to be fun. And then I drove him across the country, and it's a doc that looks like a narrative. It's a complete doc, but we shot it.
It is.
Yeah, we shot it. I mean, I shouldn't even be saying this.
Your B-roll looks...
We put a lot of care into it to make it feel like it's a narrative. Everything's like blocked off shots and very composed. And it was sort of an experiment in this, in the sense that we were trying to create what Hamed Debashi, the great Colombian university scholar, calls fantasy films, where it's based half in fact, half in fantasy. He's talking about the Iranian filmmakers.
Truman Capote invented that term.
Capotean. So it's coming in a lot. Debashi uses it to explain... Hamed Debashi, he's a great film scholar and political scholar at Columbia. He's written a lot extensively on both Iranian film and Palestinian film, and he's a great. I mean, he teaches up at Columbia too,
Maybe somebody I'll bring on.
He's incredible. He'd be an incredible interview and just a really smart guy. But anyway, he talks about fantasy films, mainly talking about Karastami and Panahi's mm-hmm. work, but also well, other Iranian
Godfrey's
filmmakers.
Ballpark.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's, Wheelhouse winner.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, yeah, Godfrey and Debashi. It's like that would be power duo right there. But
hey,
I
wouldn't even have to sit in on
yeah,
that one.
Yeah,
I
could just
let them
watch them discuss.
Tape roll.
But anyway, yeah, he always talks about fantasy films, films where you mm-hmm. capture something by using documentary elements, but putting it in almost a narrative kind of context, and it creates a whole nother level of, it puts, in a sort of Brechtian way, it puts the audience in some sort of dis-ease because, is dis-ease, disease? You know,
like
it puts
that.
Them in,
yeah.
It puts them in a place where they have to constantly be, is this real or is it fake? Is it,
I like
is it staged? Is it, is but wait, it can't be staged. And then, you know, and it sort of gives you another level of intrigue as an audience member and another critical level of intrigue, too. So we were trying to do the same thing. I mean, whether we succeeded or not, we'll let Debashi be the critic.
I'm really, really curious to see the whole thing. I can't wait to see it.
I don't know if our film is really... this is very kind of... conventional film compared to our first one.
Yeah, yeah, I know. That's
unconventional one.
Yeah, so. But I'm watching the trailer again, and maybe I didn't read all the fine print, but I was like, thought it was just a narrative. I didn't.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to make sure
you have
that it looks
so many
narrative.
Wonderful shots that are so cinematic. I mean, from the little I saw, that I'm like, it's got to be. Who does that for a documentary? But I understand that it was very intentional.
Yeah,
and
no. We just wanted to. We wanted to set up challenges for ourselves. Going back to Iranian cinema, if you have hurdles, you have to work harder and you end up coming up with something that's a little bit more interesting. And we really, it's a lot of artists do this. I mean, it's like, what is it, Jack White, who always said, we're only allowed to have two musicians in the band because that will force us to, you know, and I buy into that. You know, I really love that kind of approach because hurdles do make you come up with something different.
Yeah.
And our hurdle up to this point has been having no money. but we also put other hurdles in too, just because, I don't know, we're torturing
one
ourselves.
Second. Hello? Sorry, I popped up. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, I apologize. I was supposed to text that to you, right?
Yeah, I know.
I'm sorry, honey. Hold on. I'm going to tell you right now. It's 571.
Oh, I think if you have to put it in, maybe.
Oh, is that what? It didn't go online or anything. Is that right?
Hello?
I'm sorry, it's 571.
Text it to me, not tell me.
You can put it in your phone, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Text me the address in the street because I don't know what avenue I'm on right now. I think I'm on 3rd Avenue. I don't even know where I am.
Oh, wait, why are you on? Okay, 571, but I'll text it to you.
And text me the street, too.
39th Street, but you're going to walk uphill, not downhill.
No, avenue.
Oh, it's not on an avenue. It's on a street. Okay, bye. He knows his way around. I don't know. He's gone there so many times.
Yeah.
I guess he uses GPS.
Yeah. Kids nowadays, if it's not plugged into the phone, they're not even going to, you know. It's amazing how convenient all this stuff is, but also the inverse effect of all of it.
Right. Like I was at DMV court. The Motor Vehicle Bureau court.
Yeah. Wasn't it at Atlantic Center?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I decided to fight the ticket.
Of course.
Take points are lower the cost if you should show up. You know, you're sitting there while waiting for your turn. Mm-hmm. And the woman ahead of me was like, the GPS said to make a left at this intersection, but it was a legal left. There was, so she just told me, the GPS, I just did what and she was arguing okay, so the GPS sent you over a cliff.
Yeah. Yeah.
just use your brains. If there's a sign that says no left legal turn.
But
Waze, and she went through it with the red light, by the way.
Waze sent me down a one-way street. I can't help it. It's Waze's fault.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But these are the kind of, these are the kind of legal issues that are going to come up in the future. Like arguing whether your digital information is
evidential or whatever.
The crazy thing is that whole Voco thing where they can change your voice. Like they can take footage because you have a podcast, they could just destroy you because you have plenty of hours of your voice on tape.
Thousands.
And they put it in an algorithm or something, and then they can make you say anything. They could make, and
oh,
then
yeah,
they're doing this with facial
recognition
too, where They can take your face, and if they have enough footage, they can make it look like you're saying anything. Like it's Photoshop for the face.
But can't they also if there's somebody robbing a bank and it's on the close circuit? Can't they just put anybody in there? But then that removes all this stuff from evidence because you could argue that.
Because of course, and then so there is no truth.
Provable.
There's no way to say one thing or the other.
You could go in as an attorney. You could say we have this recording, to 911.
Yeah.
But then you could just make up another recording.
Yeah.
Using somebody else's. You could say, well, this is you.
Yeah. You know, use the judge's voice and say, no, it was the judge.
Right.
And
then exactly what I'm saying.
Turns into a total.
So and that was said, there's your said, case. You've implanted enough doubt.
But. You know, clearly the logical extension of that is that there is no truth because everybody will know, oh, it's just been doctored. Everything's been doctored. And then when everything's been doctored, then, you know, nobody's responsible for anything. And what kind of world is that? It's like you can just,
The answer is don't break the law.
Yeah. But even then, you know, it allows people to break the law to do whatever they want because they can just deny, you know. And you know,
I didn't say grab her by the, that was fake. You know, it's like,
it's crazy.
Very true.
Yeah, it's what we're going to be living with soon.
Thank you, technology. I think we are living with it. I don't think it's even soon.
It's just going to get crazier. It's going to be pretty interesting.
Well, because some of these tools now are becoming downloadable from the cloud. It's not like this is just in the hands of specific people with expertise or, you know, but it's now most people at home can do this stuff. I think that's why.
All these companies that are building these products, they're saying that they're doing it for film reasons. They're saying, but imagine if you're shooting a project and you don't have the time or the money to go and pay for ADR. You can just go and take the footage that you have of your character already speaking, plug it into our system, and then make them say what you actually wanted them to say. And then you saved hundreds or maybe thousands on your budget, you know? And as a filmmaker, I'm like, you know what? Let me just do ADR because I don't want that tool to be out in the world that's going to just allow even more of the ugly kind of chaos that we don't need. You know, it's like there's something important about not having it so easy. Again, it goes back to the hurdles thing. It's like everything at your fingertips does not necessarily make for better films. It may make sense on a budgetary standpoint or, you know, just on, you know, bottom lines. But, you know, the bottom line is what ruins films. So it's like.
Yeah, I agree.
That kind of stuff drives me crazy. Anyway, that's a tangent, but it's going to be an important tangent one day soon.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it all the more when I can watch a film that's just made from sheer
sweat
and innovation and inspiration and hunger and ambition, all these things like. You can tell, you know, when you're watching such a piece of work, regardless of what discipline it is. I mean, it's just.
I mean, I don't mind if people have a big toolbox and they have access to all those things. But, you know, a lot of the times when they do, it kills some of the soul. And you can sense soul. If you're paying attention, you can feel it.
I think that's usually the word I come down to also, which is a good word to describe it. Soul is a great term.
Yeah. And a lot of the times. The people that don't have it don't know what you're talking about.
How can people find your work, Monahan?
Well, like I said, the first film's website is lvdls.com. Mm-hmm. And that will also tell you where you can watch all the stuff online. Mm-hmm. Right now it's Fandor and Vimeo on demand. But soon all the rest of the places will be available. And I don't even know what all of them are, but there's iTunes, YouTube Red, all that stuff, Amazon. Oh. It's all going to be coming soon.
Hulu.
Yeah. Hopefully all of it. That's what we're working with Matt Grady over at Factory 25 on right now. And the second film, I don't know which festivals it's going to be playing at.
But you submitted.
We know it's premiering. We don't know where the premiere is going to be, but it's definitely going to be playing at Thessaloniki.
Telluride.
Yeah, maybe Telluride next year, not this year. I doubt it. You know, like they need premieres.
Wait, but the premiere is always the big.
Yeah, the premiere is the important one, but we don't even know where the premiere is. It may end up being. It may be. Well, let's just put it this way. There's some good ones that are trying to decide right now, but we definitely know we're playing in Europe. The European premiere is going to be likely Thessaloniki, unless it plays in Poland right before that. Thessaloniki is one of the oldest festivals in the world. It's in Thessaloniki in northern Greece.
Right. And I guess it does sound like a.
I think Venice and Cannes are the only older festivals than Thessaloniki. It's like 60 years old or something this year. Uh-huh. And it's a great, great, great festival. The people that put it together are, you know, some of the best in Europe, and they really know what they're doing.
And that's a confirmed?
That's confirmed. The one I can actually talk about. All the other ones we're still working out. But there's a bunch of good ones in Asia, in South America, and in North America. Mm-hmm. And we're just waiting to hear back from. Mm-hmm. But Sea to Shining Sea. Yeah, hopefully. Like maybe you can have, maybe when we have.
Yeah, I want you both on.
Yeah,
Sheena, and your
wife. Sheena can come by and she.
And your co-star, because he's probably going to come back, right, for a U.S. premiere.
Yeah, when we have the U.S. premiere, he'll come back, and he's a handful. He's very, very funny. We always call him the Dave Chappelle meets Mr. Bean of Europe. And it's a good mix. But he really is one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Got it a little bit off of the trailer as well.
He's
got so much
personality.
Snuck it in there.
I mean, we're nobodies, but the thing is, that's part of our thing too, is like nobodies can be just as entertaining as somebodies, and to my mind, more entertaining. And he's definitely one of the funniest people I've ever met, not the funniest person
I've ever met. That's fantastic. I love
that. He
can also call in. You know, we could do like, so. We'll figure it out.
Oh, he's good on Skype, too.
We'll figure that out.
And, he'll talk your ear off.
I've done stuff where I've had, live people, somebody Skyping in or calling in, and it's always a nice little element, actually.
He can tell you all about the film scene out in Europe and how difficult it is as a black actor to get work in Amsterdam, which is a very... You know, on the surface, it appears very, I hate to use the word, but multicultural society. But in the film world, he never gets roles. And he's like, you know, it takes doing something in the States.
Yeah.
I mean, he gets the sidekick kind of things. And but he is far the funniest person in Europe and probably in the world. And
wow.
And that's a big claim. But you know what? I'll put him toe to toe with anybody. He's, you know, in any weight class, he'll take him down. And he's legitimately, when you meet him, you'll know. It's like, he's just one of those people that you're just around him. And there's this kind of lovable goof that he can just pull off.
Wow. Sounds like a great, can't wait to meet him.
He's really good.
Well, please send me a...
I'll send you a link.
Please send me the link. I want to watch it. I want to see the film. I want to definitely see it, and I want to be able to also be part of its success. You know, in the sense of where
it goes. We'd love for you to see it. We're real proud of it. I mean, it was like a real challenge to pull it off, but we felt like, you know, it came together. It was an experiment.
You're happy with it.
Could we do this? And then it seemed to work. So
yes, we can is the answer.
Yes, we can. Didn't somebody use that as a political slogan? We actually did one of those fake Shepherd Fairy with Borlider's face and said, yes, we can. When we were trying to raise the last little bit for the Kickstarter from Fandor. So anyway, this was the Kickstarter short and our Fandor short, and it's a feature, and you can make a feature for no money.
I'm glad it all came to fruition.
Yeah.
And I still check in occasionally. I watch stuff on Vandor. So folks should check out. You can get even a trial if you don't want to commit to subscribing.
To
Fandor.
To get used to it.
Everybody that I worked with, I did a monthly podcast collaborative thing, episode with them once a month for a year or something like that. And I worked with that whole team. I didn't work directly with John Marlowe, but and since then, I mean, everybody that I ever worked with there has been scrubbed.
There's not a single solitary person that I worked with.
The entire marketing department was
none of the original band is there anymore.
It's now you're watching some Filipino.
Yeah, that guy, I was going to stand up for him, but he just went to Trump and did an appearance, the guy from Journey. I really hate Journey. I've always hated Journey. But Neil Schon, he used to play with Santana, gets a pass.
No, the guitar player. I know Neil Schon. I don't know him personally, but I remember he was the driving force.
But yeah, he gets
a
pass because he complained about the rest of the band going and meeting Trump. So he gets a little respect for Journey.
Yeah, what was that guy? Yeah, it was a great documentary, if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, I've heard all about it. I haven't watched it, but I know the story, but maybe I'll watch it. But anyway.
Well, it was made by the director was a Filipino. So, you know, how many times are there, like, you know, an enormous Filipino stars? Twice, it turns out. You know, there's the guy who replaced...
Steve Perry.
Yeah. He replaced Steve Perry.
Yeah, somebody who can't stand Journey, I know a lot about Journey.
I really
can't stand that the millennials like that song, Don't Stop Believing.
That was the name of the documentary.
But they really like that song. Like, they love that song. Like, all these EDM guys, they mix it in. It's the worst. It makes me want to, you know, blow my brains out. But
don't do that. Then what's the other kid? He's an enormous world pop star.
Justin Bieber?
No. He's Filipino.
Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars.
He's a Filipino success story.
Yeah. There aren't too many.
But there are great filmmakers from Philippines.
Yes.
But coming from the skateboard world, I know many Filipinos that are superstars. There is a lot of Filipino great skateboarders. So that's another whole different subject. Oh, I can also give you my website, which is bricolagista.com. That's BRICOLAGISTA.com.
Bricolagista.
Yeah, bricolage is the, you know, making something out of whatever you can get your hands on.
Is that like decoupage?
Yeah, sort of similar. It's like do-it-yourself, DIY kind of whatever. So Bricolagista is a practitioner of making something out of nothing. So
I like that.
That's our company name. And bricolagista.com. And I don't know. Yeah, we'd love to talk to you. We're already working on our next film, raising money for that. So
good.
That takes place in Japan. That's a whole another hurdle.
This is how you take vacations.
Yeah.
I understand.
It's how you take vacations, but you know, trying to raise the money is like going to war. So it's
I know that
difficult thing. So
but
this is the first one with like a proper budget. So this is going to be a big deal, and we're super excited. And we have the world's best cinematographer working with us on that, and I'll keep it secret for now, but I'll tell you privately. And we're really excited about that one. It's going to be good.
Well, you're always welcome back to Greece.
Well, we're neighbors. We're right next. Yeah, we're right down the street. So
I know.
Good.
I may walk you home.
Yeah, it's good.
But I hope I remain a neighbor, at least relatively close by.
You're Brooklyn. It's close enough. It's going to be wherever you end up. I can't imagine you moving to Staten Island, so it's going
to
be fun.
No, I can't do that. Yeah, no, I think I'd sooner move to, back to Queens, from whence I hail, before I do that.
Queens is okay. Queens gets a pass. Staten Island, not so much.
A little bit.
Although there's a few good things.
I'm sure there's perfectly any good people from Staten Island. And I may have listeners there. So thank you.
We love you, Staten Island.
We do.
Shaolin.
Yes. You don't want us living there, though.
It's a bad mix.
All the filmmakers are kind of in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Not all. There are many elsewhere, but it makes sense for me to be in Brooklyn, in the hub. But thank you, Monahan. It's great to finally get you on. You have been on.
Yeah, briefly.
But you were on briefly, and it was over the phone or something.
Yeah, I think it was over the phone or Skype or something like that.
Yeah, so this is great to bring you back on properly.
Great to meet you in person. That's
same
great.
Same here, yeah.
All right, excellent. Thanks.
Thank you.